This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, actor William Hurt, was recently in prison, not doing time, just preparing for his role as an ex-con in the new film The Yellow Handkerchief. Hurt became famous in the early 80s for his starring roles in the film noir Body Heat, the thriller Eyewitness, and the science fiction film Altered States. He won an Oscar for his performance in Kiss of the Spider-Woman as a drag queen sharing a prison cell with a political dissident. Hurt's performance as a gangster in the David Cronenberg film A History of Violence was so amazing he was nominated for an Oscar, even though he was in just one scene. Last year he had a starring role in the FX series Damages. Hurt's new film, The Yellow Handkerchief, is set in post-Katrina Louisiana. At the beginning of the film, he gets out of prison after serving 6 years for reasons that become clear as the story unravels. He's trying to travel back to the woman he loves, but he doesn't know if she'll take him back. He gets a ride with two teenagers, played by Kristen Stewart and Eddie Redmayne. In this scene, the three of them are in the car. Hurt is driving when they're stopped by the police.
And I need to see your license, please, sir. Sir, I need to see your license, please.
I don't have one.
So you've been driving without a license, sir?
No.
Could you speak up, please, sir?
My license is expired.
Well, then you've been driving without a license, haven't you?
No, sir, this is my...
Quiet. Why is that, sir?
Tell me your name, please, sir. Sir, could you please tell me your name?
I don't have a license because I've been in prison the last 6 years. The kids don't know anything about this. I hitched a ride with them, and I took the wheel when I hit... They don't know anything about it.
All right, so slowly, put your left hand behind your back. Now your other hand.
William Hurt, welcome to Fresh Air. It's really a pleasure to have you here. Let me start by asking you to describe your character in The Yellow Handkerchief.
My character is blue collar. Originally from probably Kentucky, ran into trouble, works as a steam fitter on oil rigs, and moved to Louisiana after he ran into drug trouble, tried to make a new life, met someone, fell in love with them, got into an accidental bit of trouble which put him in prison for a long time, and he takes a road trip with some young people after he gets out.
Now, I read that you spent some time in a prison talking to inmates so that you could learn about what your character might be like. So what prison did you go to, and what did you want to know?
We were in Angola, in northern Louisiana, and a prison that's gone through a lot of changes in the last few years since its heyday isn't the right word, since its horror days. And I spent one night in maximum security there. I think I'm the only person who electively has done that. I think someone else tried to, but screamed and gave up at midnight. I spoke with every member on that row, who's incarcerated in an 8-foot by 4-foot cell 23 hours a day for the rest of their lives. Those who would speak to me, some wouldn't. I had 4 days... basically on the grounds with many people, asking them questions about their lives, what got them there, what it was like there, how they were now, what they thought. And I learned a lot.
So would you describe what it felt like to be in this small maximum security cell?
Claustrophobic isn't the word. It's much worse. I didn't think that I was uncomfortable most of the night. I was preoccupied with my companion, and the bed has about 1.5-inch thick mattress on sheer steel. The toilet has no soft seat. The floor is marbleized concrete. It's horrible. It's unthinkable.
So when you were interviewing or speaking with men who were in that maximum security unit, did they know who you were? Did they know your films?
Oh, they were told who I was. They were told why I was there.
But were they...
Some chose... Sorry?
Were they familiar with your movies?
To some extent, some of them knew that I wasn't, an actor. Most of the films I make are not most of the films they see.
Mm-hmm.
In the maximum security division, the cells are all on one side of a hallway because the definition of maximum security is no human contact. So they don't want them communicating with anybody. They put them next to each other with walls in between them, but they won't put them facing another cell so they can't communicate with anybody facially or by hand signals.
So you had all your conversations...
Around a corner.
Around the corner, not being able to see the person you were talking to.
Not all of them. I was taken with a group of guards to the front of each cell and allowed to ask a few questions with a team of guards standing around me to protect me, from someone who couldn't get out. And, of course, that intimidates any conversation. Then I moved through the row and finally got to my cell, which is at one end. They had vacated a prisoner for that one night for my access.
So what did you take away from the experience of being in Angola in prison and speaking to prisoners who were in the maximum security wing? What did you take away from that you were able to use in the movie?
It's pretty limitless. Primarily sorrow for them. Most of the time I would ask them, why are you here? And most of the time they would answer second-degree murder. Of 5,108 inmates, 85% of the people in there are going to die there. So there's no compunction when you're talking to someone whose only desire on earth is not to have their body buried on the grounds of that prison. There's no problem in being frank. There's no compunction about telling the truth. Conversations are wonderfully, refreshingly, brutally honest.
Were you shocked by anything you heard?
No, I've been around. This isn't the first time I've talked to prisoners. It isn't the first time I've talked to murderers.
For movies or for other reasons?
For various reasons. I used to visit prisons. It's kind of, as an outsider taking a message to prisoners about hope, I can't really go into that.
Oh, that's too personal, you mean?
No, it's personal for other people.
Right, okay. But that was work you were doing, though, going to prisons to take a message of hope?
You'd call it charitable work. I had worked with some people who were involved in a prison program, and they periodically visited the prisons in Rockland County, in New York State, to take a program of hope and self-rehabilitation to them. And I would accompany them. And so I met a lot of people that way. And also, this is a little hard to say rightly, but... I've always been interested in people, and I've been interested in people who are off the track. I ran into problems, for instance, in Brazil 25 years ago when, by accident, I was taken hostage on a dark night in a small village south of São Paulo and, had a guy with a gun in my pocket who was going to blow my genitals off, and then after an hour, he told us to face the wall, and we were sure he was going to shoot us.
Whoa. Let's back up. What happened? Why were you taken hostage? Was this while you were making Kiss of the Spider Woman?
Yes, and we had 36 hours off from filming, and me and my date at the time got into a car, and we drove south to a village where her parents had a small villa in a very modest town with dirt streets. And as we drove into the driveway at midnight, a car pulled up behind us and blocked our exit. The engine of that car was turned off. There were four people in it, two men and two women. One of the men had a ski mask on, a black ski mask. The other man just had his face. And the one man leaned out the window and he said to us, we were standing outside our car, we just arrived. They must have been following us. And he said something in Portuguese, and I asked my date, what do you say? And she turned white, and she said, he wants directions. So she knew right away. And after that, the doors of the car opened, and they both got out with guns. And
how'd you get out of it?
Well, what do they say in Sanskrit? They say life is about creation, sustenance, dissolution, control, and the bestowal of grace, right? Probably the bestowal of grace. We were in the house for an hour, and one man, the guy in the ski mask, his duty was to hold the gun on us in the corner and shift us around the house while the other guy carried everything out of the house and put it into our car. There were a couple of times when I thought the guy was ready to pull the trigger, and you could see the bullets. So it wasn't fake. And he and I were just looking at each other for about an hour, me at his eyes through the mask. Anyway, he told us to face the wall, and I knew he was going to shoot us. And so I said, no, I can't do that. And my feeling was, if I'm going to die now, I want to be looking into another human being's eyes, even if it's yours.
Did you say that to him?
I did, eventually, yeah.
And
he drove me to the ground. He put the gun in my forehead, and he leaned on it with all his might, and he was screaming at me. And we both went to the floor, his face a few inches from mine. He's screaming at me in Portuguese. My date was collapsing in the corner. And I just was looking at him very, very steadily, and I just kept saying, I don't want it in the back of the head. And and he backed away slowly, and he said, don't call the police for 15 minutes or I will find a way to come back and kill you. And he left. So I called the police pretty much right away, and eventually they showed up, and they were almost worse than he was. I mean, really, there's a lot of violence in the world. So I've seen not just that, but I've seen it in other places as well. My father worked for AID. He was the head of AID in Lahore, Khartoum, Mogadishu. I lived in all those places with him when I was young. I grew up in the South Pacific. Basically, my brothers were Guamanian. I spoke words of Guamanian long before I spoke words of English. And so I've seen a lot. You know, I've traveled in places where people don't have the benefits of American life. And so I've seen a lot of stuff. So the prison was not new to me.
Right. After hearing that story, we should hear what you were doing professionally as that was happening with you, and listen to a clip from Kiss of the Spider Woman. Because, I mean, now in that movie, you're in prison. We've been talking about prison.
Right.
You were nearly killed while making this movie.
Well, we weren't allowed to tell anybody about it at the time because we would have had to stop making the movie.
Why? Because
people there would have
been
so
scared?
Much press attention. That's right. No, press attention, and then people accusing the production of being irresponsible and blah, 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 you know?
And then also the people who kidnapped you would have known where to find you because they'd know
No, they had a gun battle with the police the next morning, and the women were captured by the police and were being beaten to death while we went to the police station. We had to beg them on our knees to stop, and the men were being chased by and corralled in the jungle where they had fled, and the police were running around showing everybody proudly, you know, shells from the exchange of gunfire. So, no, they weren't going to find us, and that wasn't the point. The point was that I didn't want to embarrass the lady. I didn't want the false, you know, we were asked not to bring false attention to the production, or we would have had to pull a plug on it. And you couldn't say anything because you would attract all this attention that would distract from the making of a film that we were doing on spec anyway. The real problem was the press.
The two stars of the film are you and Raul Julia, and you're both in a prison cell together. You're there. You play a drag queen who's had sex with an underage boy. That's why you're in prison. He's there. He's a political prisoner. He's in the resistance.
Not an underage boy.
No, who was it?
They said it was, but it was just for being homosexual.
Just for being gay, right.
Just for being gay.
Yeah.
So, and for being flagrant about it.
Yes, because you're kind of a drag queen in it, and you have this real like romantic view of the world. You have a very romantic sensibility, and even though you're in prison, you're wearing this like flowered robe, and you've put a towel on your head as a turban. And because Raul Julia is in such pain, he's been tortured, he's bleeding, you're trying to divert him and entertain him by telling the story of a film that you saw that you think is a really like thrilling and romantic film. And you're kind of doing it as if you're narrating the film. You're telling him the whole story of the film. He kind of figures out that it's a film. It's a Nazi propaganda film, but you don't you don't realize that.
But I didn't get that. But I interpret it as romantic sentimentalism.
Yeah. So in this scene from the beginning of the film, you're narrating the movie, and Raul Julia keeps interrupting you with kind of cynical comments. He is not a romantic like you are, and you're defending the film before continuing the story of the film. Here's the scene.
I know it's nothing terribly intellectual like you must be used to. It's just a romance, but it's so beautiful. Now, suddenly, this military convoy rushes forward. Marvelous German soldiers catch those weird smugglers in the act and arrest them all. Nearby is this small truck with these two French thugs from the resistance who are spying on the Germans. This hulking clubfoot and his half-deaf flunky.
Wait a minute. Those weird guys the Germans arrested?
Yes.
What do you mean they didn't look French?
They didn't look French. They looked, Turkish. I'm not sure, but they had these like these caps on their heads, like these. Turkish, like fezes.
Those caps are yarmulkes. Can't you see this is a f***ing anti-Semitic film?
Oh, come on.
Wait. This must have been a German movie, right?
I don't know. It was from years ago. Look, I don't explain my movies. It just ruins the emotion.
This must have been a Nazi propaganda film done during the war.
I don't know. That's just the background. This is where the important part begins, the part about the lovers. It's divine.
It's my guest William Hurt with Raul Julia in a scene from the film Kiss of the Spider Woman. It's such a good film. Your character in that is someone who sees life as theater. You know, life is, he wants his
life
to be theater.
But he ends up sacrificing himself.
That's right. Yeah, he ends up becoming quite political in the end.
Well, he ends up sacrificing himself for the person he loves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, in playing the drag queen in Kiss of the Spider Woman, what did you want to capture about the character's way of moving and speaking?
Capture isn't my word for anything. It's more like release. You know, when people capture things, they put them in cages. I don't put the truth in a cage. I try to find a way to release it. But I do use a form, which is a prison itself. It was that there is something in that human being's soul. I didn't play him, by the way, as gay. I played him as a woman. And it was a big point for me during the rehearsal we had. And by the way, rehearsal was key and is always key. And almost all the really good work I've ever done had a lot of rehearsal. Because it became a collaborative, a true collaboration, rather than a false one. Just showing up and jumping out of the box, which is what we're usually paid to do. It was that there was something in that being's heart that was searching for the truth that really went beyond politics, if you want to call it that. So this guy, this human being, goes beyond that and proves himself more of a man in many ways, ironically, than many men.
When you say you played the character as a woman, not as a gay man,
the key for me as an artist, as I was researching the character, I had a wonderful teacher there, a dance teacher, who was helping me try to figure out how to move, because every character has different movements. And physical life. And I would, I spent time, for instance, the same way I spent time in Angola asking prisoners, about their lives. I spent a lot of time in gay bars and trying to, you know, soak that up too. I'm not gay myself, but many of my friends are. And I wasn't getting it. There was something that wasn't working. And I was walking in the street one day, and I was looking at a woman who was walking ahead of us. We were walking down the street the same direction. And I said, you know, I don't think Molina's gay. I think he's a woman. I think he really is a woman. He's just caught in a man's body. Like, you know, sometimes I'm an actor caught in a movie star's body.
You had mentioned years ago in an interview that when you were rehearsing with Raul Julia, you switched roles with him so that he played...
It's a very rare technique to use between actors because actors should never comment on each other. I recently had an actor step back from me in a scene that we had just shot, and he said, you did good in that. And I'm going, my thought, I didn't tell him that at the time, but I thought is, how dare you comment on me while you're working with me? You know?
What's wrong with that?
How can you be in the scene and looking at it at the same time?
I see.
You can't be judging something as you do it. You have to have judged it before, and maybe you can judge it after, but not during. During it, you're just committed. You're doing something. You're not thinking.
So getting back to when you switched roles with Raul Julia as you were making Kiss of the Spider Woman, and you became the...
You're insistent.
Well, I just wanted to know what you got from it. You became the political prisoner, and he became...
It's something you rarely do. You never do it because you don't want another actor commenting on it. But Raul and I had a great friendship, and we respected each other very much as artists. So I suggested it to him one day because we were feeling rushed about rehearsal, and we weren't getting to places I thought we could get to. And he took it on. We used to sneak to the Quonset hut we were making Spider-Woman on Sundays, unbeknownst to the producers. We weren't allowed to go there because it was a dangerous city. And we would work under a naked light bulb on the platform. And we reversed roles. I played Valentina, he played Molina. And we made all these incredible discoveries very, very quickly, but only because we trusted each other immensely as people. And as artists, were we able to use those discoveries? Otherwise, we would have seen them as invasion and commentary.
Mm-hmm. Did you change anything about your performance after that exercise?
I enhanced it. He was so much better than I was, in my view, at what we were doing, that we went running back, and I said, I knocked, like hammered on the director's door, and I said, we have to change roles. And the director panicked and said, no, we have to have a talk. And so we weren't posing, and we were talked out of it, but we were inspired mm-hmm. by each other's discoveries, and it basically gave us each immense amounts of permission to go further into the choices we'd already made, but just freed up.
If you're just joining us, my guest is William Hurt, and he's starring in the new movie, The Yellow Handkerchief. Now, earlier you mentioned that you're very interested in people who've gone off the track. So I thought I'd play an example of one of your roles where the character has gone off the track. And this is another no. great film, it's called History of Violence.
Oh.
And it's a movie that's directed by David Cronenberg. You're only in one scene in this, but you are so good that, you know, when you leave the movie, you're thinking you're thinking about this scene. So the main character in the movie, you're the brother of the main character in the movie. The main character in the movie is played by Viggo Mortensen. He used to be a gangster, but he wanted out of that life. So he's moved to a small town. He's changed his name. He's renounced violence. He now owns a diner that he runs with his wife. He has, I think, two children. And then just to, I won't complicate things, but he gets dragged into violence after the diner is robbed. And then his past starts coming up to haunt him. And he knows that you, his brother, who's still in crime, is in part to blame for this. So he goes to pay you a call at your fancy home. And first you have him frisked, even though he's not carrying. And then you pour yourself a drink, you give him a big kiss and a big hug, and he's just like wincing because he doesn't even want to be in your presence. He just wants out. And then you explain why you can't let him off the hook. Here's the scene.
You know you cost me a lot of time and money. Before you pull that with Fogarty, I was a shoo-in to take over when the boss croaked. A shoo-in. It was made very clear to me, Joey. I had to clean up your mess
or nothing was ever gonna happen for me. You got no idea how much I had to pull to get back in with those guys. You cost me a hell of a lot, Joey. A hell of a lot.
Looks like you're doing all right over here.
Yeah, I am. I am. I'm still behind the eight ball. Because of you, there's a certain lack of respect, a certain lack of trust. Boys in Boston are just waiting for me to go down. You always were a problem for me, Joey. When Mom brought you home from the hospital, I tried to strangle you in your crib. I guess all kids try to do that. She caught me, whacked the daylights out of me.
I've heard that story.
Well, what do you think? Better late than never.
Richie, I'm here to make peace. Tell me what I gotta do to make things right.
You could do something, I guess. You could die, Joey.
And that's the sounds of one of your henchmen trying to to kill Viggo Mortensen. It's such a good scene, and this character you play him in, he sounds like an overgrown child. He sounds like a like a child who has
that's
a
exactly
lot of,
right. He never
like
got
a lot of power
of
and a lot of guns.
He's
and
right
stuff.
Back there in the room where his mother's whacking him down for doing exactly what she told him to do, which is win, be your little man. Be the guy. Be the macho boy. Beat all comers, including your brother. And when he does it, she whacks him down so he gets polarized. He lives in a trauma for the rest of his life.
So the way you're playing him, he's kind of like wielding his power, but it's coming off almost like whining.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. He's a kid. The way a lot of violent people are basically big kids, but they're very dangerous, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
They're children, and they're crying out. They're just crying out with violence because they feel unattended. They feel no one was listening.
So tell us more about, like, just the way you played the role, like what you did to prepare for it.
Well, that was, you know, David was so kind with me.
It's David Cronenberg, the director.
Yes, yes, yes. I arrived 10 days early. I filmed only for a couple of days. I'm of the belief there are no small roles, only small actors, you know, that old phrase.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you, this is literally, yeah, in terms of time, it's a small role. In terms
but
of
But that
its
framework
impact,
doesn't work for me, you know, who cares? You know, if you're alive, if some people, you know, I've met 8-year-olds that have more wisdom than 80-year-olds. So my mom died young, and she had a great life. So, you know, you can't measure things in terms of time, at least quality. And so-called main characters, what's that? We're all main characters. We're all main characters in our life.
Okay, so getting back to playing the role. I'm prepared
yeah.
for it.
I arrived 10 days early, and I asked him if he'd pay for a hotel room and get me a dialect coach. And he did. And then the key was Vigo's generosity, because even though he was at the end of a very long shoot and therefore just wacko tired, he must have been exhausted, he would give me evenings. We would have dinner almost every night, and we would talk about the basics of the character, where they were from, given circumstances. He and Maria had developed this incredible array of wonderful given circumstances for their characters, and he shared that with me. In fact, though I only met Maria just one time,
this is Maria Bello.
Film,
yeah,
yeah, she was the one who actually filled us all in because she came from Philadelphia. She knew all about it, and she and Vigo had done all this research together. So Vigo passed that on to me, and I just based the character on their given circumstances so I could make them all come from the same world. That's what I was doing. And from there came the character. That to me, that was not somebody waltzing in, dropped in by helicopter, jumping out of a box and doing a great cameo. That was an actor working with another actor, and out of the conversation between those actors comes, emanates the character. You don't just show up and do a performance. It's an it's It's a reflection of a process. And if that process of the 10 days beforehand hadn't been there, I would have done a terrible job in that film.
And what did you want the dialect coach for?
The sound, his speech. Talking like this, you know, Richie talking in there like that. You know, but I also thought of it as a farce. And a grandiose farce. And very, very funny. So I saw him as trapped between these images of himself as, you know, half Italian mafia, half Irish mafia, and half John Wayne. So, I thought it was so funny. And that's what I basically did with him, was create these bigger-than-thou, bigger-than-himself images so that he could bluster his way through life and pretend that he was strong enough to stand up to his mom.
Right.
Because she was the one that trounced him for being for doing exactly what she and his dad had told him to do, which is be number one and pounce on everybody else.
So we've been talking about your approach to acting. Has it changed over the years? Or do you approach roles differently now than you used to when you, like, say, in the Body
Heat
era?
Well, to me, I mean, there's a standard. And the standard was something I arrived at understanding about after I'd been looking for it for 15 years of study. The standard is 6 weeks of rehearsal, 42 days to hatch a character the way, you know, 9 months to hatch a kid. I don't know why it's true. I don't know why we need 9 months, but it is true for me. And anything less is results in a premature character. That means, of course, that I'm guilty of launching a lot of premature characters out there the way we live in a post-adolescent society. But I always have that image of what a proper rehearsal would be, where we would go in every day, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and prove that we were friendly to each other, not competing with each other. Where we would check our ego guns at the door, go in, inspire each other, communicate with each other, research with each other, and bring about the best possible life that can be breathed into that play. Stanislavski said, when he was asked a question by a young actor once, what is it that I do? I don't create anything. I don't write the words. I don't write the themes. I don't write the beauty. Am I an artist? Do I create? He says, of course you create. You breathe the ethic into the play. And he says that's essential. A lot of people don't understand the ethic of ensemble at all. They offer awards for ensemble when I can guarantee you that the only thing that those people had in common was that they maybe all met the director, but they never worked together. They never sat in rooms, you know, before shooting, before judgment, before the, you know, the array of critiques and opinions. And they never got past auditioning for the next job. They never had the job. You know what I'm saying? They never felt secure. And I believe in being secure, and I believe in proving my trustworthiness to another actor. I'm not just there to gun him down, not there to beat him, not there to win. When people turned the role in History of Violence into the shortest Academy Award nomination in history, I was chagrined by that. That's not what we did. It was a role. It's a guy. All the roles could be that great. Everybody can be that great. Everybody can be that vivid. You know, if you do the work right, everybody's vivid. Every life is vivid. That's what we're trying to say, right?
You were telling me before the interview started that although, you know, you're in L.A. right now to do this interview, you actually live in Oregon, in an unpopulated area.
I live in the county where my mother was born and buried.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that why you live there?
That's basically it. I took my two middle boys there after we had troubles, you know, relating to their mom, who was sick. And after I got them back into my permanent custody, I was looking for a place to put a foundation under their feet, and I sent up a little prayer by a balloon, and I said, Mom, what the heck do I do to save our lives? And she said, bring them home. So I put them in a VW bus, and I took them to, you know, the place where she was born and buried in eastern Oregon, and I put them in a one-room schoolhouse.
Wow.
Where there was a lady who knew the difference between a math grade and a human being. And we're doing great.
Do you visit your mother's grave often? I mean, does the substance of a grave, like the physicality of a grave, have meaning
for you? It
means a lot
to me. Yeah. On my mother's grave, it says, don't coddle me into the grave. I'm going to march into it. I'm a man after all. It also says, "The truth shall make you free," and there's a picture of a butterfly on a very flat stone in a lost cemetery that you can't see till you're 15 feet away from it in the sage prairies of the Great Basin of America. Not far from a piece of you know, dirt where her grandfather had a reputation for poverty and for hospitality, so that anybody who showed up at his door ate. That's within sight of her gravestone, but you can't find it if you don't know where it is. And she's next to her mom, who was troubled, and her grandfather. On his gravestone it says he played a poor hand well, and his parents, who had come out to that remote section of the world, that very dry, high desert, to help their son, my great-grandfather, care for his two baby girls, who were all he had left after he had come down by ox-drawn cart in the winter in 1902 from British Columbia to be, of all things, a wheat farmer in the most impossible earth imaginable. So that means a great deal to me. My father's buried in Kentucky, and that means a lot to me, too. My first cousin, by the way, on my father's mother's side, was John Marshall Harlan, who was a Supreme Court justice, as was his grandson. Hmm. And I think a lot of my fight and my work to struggle for fairness in the techniques of theater and in subject matter probably stems in some way from some sense I have of his issues in life. He was the one and only Supreme Court justice to stand up to all eight other justices in Plessy versus Ferguson. And his words became the prototype for the rescinding of Plessy in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. So there is a natural connection to civil issues, and I think that has a lot to do with why I do what I do.
Can I just say also one more thing? It sounds like your mother came from a background of small town and poverty. Your father came from a family with a Supreme Court justice in it. It sounds like two very different places.
They were very different. They met in China. I was conceived in China. I was conceived in Shanghai, China in 1949.
Your father was in the State Department or something?
He became a member of State. The State Department didn't exist at that time.
Oh.
And the Department of the Interior did, and State evolved out of that. My mom, during the war, had gotten pregnant with her husband, an American soldier, in New York City, having come, you know, to New York from what some people would call a cultural backwater. I don't call it that. And he went off to the war before she came to term. He was so badly battle damaged that he came back with mental damage and couldn't function. And his parents said, "We'll take him if you'll take yours." And so she had a pair of high heels and a kid in New York during the war. She was such a brilliant woman that she managed to work herself up from below the bottom rung of the Time Inc. ladder to become an assistant and an essential member of a team. She was asked by Charlie Stillman, who was one of the appointees of Henry R. Luce, to go to Shanghai to help Chiang Kai-shek consolidate the retreat to Formosa and establish nationalist China. So she went. She put my brother in school in the Philippines, went to Shanghai, met my dad there, who was liaising between the communists and the nationalists for the Department of the Interior. And then when State and AID were being established in the early 50s, he became a prominent chief of AID eventually. But he was head of the Trust Territories, which is why I lived in Guam during the early 50s. And then as AID developed in the mid-50s, he became head of that in Asia and Africa. So there was my dad on the one hand, but my parents divorced in 60, which is why I then went to live in sort of Spanish Harlem, Yorkville, in New York with my mom for a few years. But I spent a year and a half in Lahore during that time, during the coup d'etat, 58-59. So I've seen a lot of stuff. And then my mom remarried in 60, the son of the founder of Time Inc., the son of Henry R. Luce, Henry Luce III, who became my stepfather. I moved from 3.5 rooms on the Upper East Side to a 22-room duplex in Madison Avenue in the Carlisle, and sitting on Louis XV with the VR Vlaminck Corot on the walls and Ming and Dang to talk about. And so it's been quite a journey. And from all that, I have had three amazing parents, my father, my stepfather, and my mother. And they bestowed on me amazing privileges of education and experience that from which I refer for my work. And that's one of the reasons why people sometimes say that I'm variegated in my work choices.
Well, William Hurt, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
It's been great to talk with you. Thank you again.
Same here.
Okay.
Thank you, Terry.
William Hurt stars in the new movie, The Yellow Handkerchief. One of the most acclaimed international films of the last year is the Israeli film Ajami, a time-warping crime drama set in Jaffa that is one of 5 Oscar nominees for Best Foreign Language Film. Made by an unusual pair of writer-directors, one is an Israeli Arab, the other an Israeli Jew, Ajami has begun playing theaters around the United States. Our critic at large, John Power, says that the movie offers a vision of Israeli life we don't often see in America.
Every American journalist knows that one topic that always gets you in trouble is Israel, even if you're just reviewing movies. Over the years, I've gotten letters calling me pro-terrorist and anti-Semitic, a dupe of the Israel lobby and a Zionist racist, not to mention a coward who believes in moral equivalence. For a great many Americans, there's only one true position on Israel, only one righteous side. In Israel itself, people know better. A wonderful example of this is the gripping new film Ajami, which was written and directed by Skandar Kopti, an Arab Israeli, and Yaron Shani, an Israeli Jew. The movie takes its name from its setting, the Ajami neighborhood of the port city of Jaffa, which is something of a bumper car rink filled with daily collisions between Israeli Jews, Israeli Arabs, both Muslim and Christian, and the Palestinians who've entered the country illegally. Ajami begins with Bedouin gangsters gunning down a teenager on the street, by mistake. You see, the killers thought they were shooting a young man named Omar. Omar himself had done nothing wrong, but his uncle had shot a Bedouin extortionist, and in this neighborhood, everything is ultimately and inescapably familial and tribal. Guilt by association is one of life's givens. As its beginning suggests, Ajami is a tale suffused with grit, the endlessly ramifying mess of urban life. Yet Kopti and Shani steer clear of the plodding linearity that can make realism so deadly. In fact, the plot is something of a brain teaser. Told in 5 chapters, this tale of crime and revenge shuffles past and present a bit like Pulp Fiction, although it creates a far denser world than Tarantino's. There are scads of characters, including the Muslim Omar, his Arab-Christian girlfriend Hadir, his friend Binge, a charming Arab doper with a Jewish girlfriend, a sweet-faced Palestinian illegal Malik, and an explosive Jewish cop Dando, whose brother has gone missing from the Israeli army. The neighborhood is so packed with interesting characters and situations that it reminded me of the HBO series The Wire. I kept thinking that Ajami would be even better and less schematic if it could run for 10 or 12 hours and give its characters a bit more room to breathe. As it is, Kopti and Shani do a nice job of capturing the texture of life, be it Omar and Hadir's secretive flirting, Binge cracking up his pals with a goofy dance, or the terrific scene when a local Arab judge negotiates how much Omar must pay the Bedouins so they won't kill him and his family, in reprisal for something that everyone agrees wasn't remotely their fault. Of course, to get this money, Omar is driven into crime that will breed further violence. And so it goes. Kids and crooks, cops and restaurateurs, everyone's held hostage by what's happened before, which is essentially how Israeli and Palestinian politics play out to this day. Every action, however bad, is justified as a response to something bad that happened earlier, all the way back to an original sin that happened decades or even millennia ago. I think that's one reason why Kopti and Shani have chosen to tell their story out of chronological order. By muddying the lines of causality, so-and-so did this because somebody else did that first, the movie avoids the logic of blame in order to reveal the horror of entrapment. In the process, Ajami offers a portrait of Israeli life that's both harder-edged and bleaker than American accounts of Israel, or to be frank, American accounts of America. With a compassionate sense of human frailty, it depicts a society in which even the most decent people are imprisoned in social identities they didn't freely choose, and find themselves inexorably pushed toward a thuggishness that isn't natural to them. It's a dark, unsparing vision. Yet what makes watching bearable, even pleasurable, is Kopti and Shani's humane intelligence. They step outside the infinite regress of attack and reprisal to show us the tragic reality of characters, none perfect but none monstrous, who live knee-deep in the swamp of history. And in this swamp, Ajami makes clear, Everybody has his reasons, and nobody can be completely clean. It's a thought worth remembering, especially for those who specialize in writing angry letters.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and writes the Absolute Powers blog for Vogue.com. You can watch clips from Ajami on our website, freshair.npr.org.